A leaf suspended in a spider's web, trembling in morning light. Wind currents, gravity, silk architecture, all conspiring to create accidental beauty that our minds insist means something. This image captures the heart of what it means to be human. We are cosmic accidents who became conscious enough to ask why we're here. Every atom in your body once belonged to an exploding star 13.8 billion years ago. The calcium in your bones, the iron in your blood, the oxygen you're breathing right now, all forged in stellar furnaces. We spend our lives drawing boundaries between ourselves and the world, clinging to permanence, mistaking chance for choice. Yet beneath these illusions pulses a deeper truth. Everything connects to everything else in an intricate dance of existence that spans galaxies and generations. Johannes Kepler raced through Germany in 1615 to save his mother from witchcraft charges, ironically sparked by his own science fiction story. This astronomer had revolutionized science by discovering elliptical planetary orbits, introducing force into physics, and predicting eclipses with stunning accuracy. Yet, he still drew horoscopes and believed rats spawned from mud. For 6 years, he meticulously challenged superstitions with logic and testimony. His contradiction reveals something essential. We never advance in straight lines. Old beliefs coexist with new discoveries, the cosmic and the intimate dancing together through human consciousness. At 12, Maria Mitchell counted 117 seconds as the moon formed a glowing ring against Nantucket's cobalt sky. She would become America's first professional woman astronomer in an era when women couldn't vote or study advanced mathematics. Her achievement emerged from a remarkable collision: a Quaker father who taught her telescopes as intellectual equals, a maritime town where mathematics served navigation, and a community where women managed businesses while men sailed for years. In 1847, working as a bank librarian, Mitchell spotted a telescopic comet from the roof. The King of Denmark awarded her a gold medal, but fame left her unmoved. Medals are small things in the light of the stars. She became Vassar's first faculty member, inspiring generations of women scientists. Yet Mitchell grasped something crucial. To discuss whether women have the capacity for original investigation in science is simply idle until equal opportunity is given them. Her father kept a water-filled glass bowl that scattered forbidden rainbows, scientific justification for pure aesthetic pleasure. Margaret Fuller rose before dawn at 15, walking, practicing piano, reading French literature, studying philosophy, learning Greek, all before breakfast. Denied formal education because of her gender, she declared, "I am determined on distinction." By 25, grieving her father's death, she met Ralph Waldo Emerson. Their meeting of minds magnetized into something beyond intellect, prompting him to shudder, "There is no terror like that of being known." Their relationship defied categorization, not quite friend, lover, mentor, or muse. After Fuller demanded clarity and Emerson went silent for a month, he finally begged, "Let us live as we have always done, only ever better." They embodied the porcupine dilemma, creatures huddling for warmth but wounding each other with quills, forever seeking optimal distance. Unable to negotiate this directly, they confronted it through Fuller's public conversation series, where their complex relationship could play out in safer intellectual territory. She would become America's first female newspaper editor and foreign war correspondent, signing her influential editorials with a single star. In 1851, Harriet Hosmer outpaced boastful young men to scale a 500-foot Mississippi bluff. The impressed steamboat captain named it Mount Hosmer, a name it still bears. This followed her groundbreaking anatomical studies at St. Louis Medical School, extraordinary for a 21-year-old woman, decades before universities officially admitted women. After losing her mother and siblings to tuberculosis before age 12, Hosmer's physician father prescribed an all-outdoors regimen. She embraced nature passionately, modeling wildlife from Charles River Clay. In Rome, she found paradise among expatriate queer women and fellow artists. Elizabeth Barrett Browning admired how Hosmer emancipates the eccentric life of a perfectly emancipated female from all shadow of blame by the purity of hers. Her masterpiece, Zenobia in Chains, portrayed the captive 3rd-century queen still regal despite defeat, one strong hand holding up the chain between shackled wrists. Hosmer explained, "I have tried to make her too proud to exhibit passion or emotion of any kind. Not subdued, though a prisoner, but calm, grand, and strong within herself. She rejected marriage as incompatible with artistic ambition and demanded real payment. It is time that I was paid in more glittering currency than glory." When Susan Gilbert returned after 10 months away, something had shifted. Perhaps the separation revealed an asymmetry of affections where mutuality was presumed. That summer, Emily Dickinson cut off her auburn hair. While Emily could only dream of a fantasy marriage interceded by the preacher whose name is love, Austin married Susan within society's acceptable framework. They moved into the Evergreens, across the western hedge from the homestead. A little path just wide enough for two who love formed between the houses. Over the next quarter century, 276 known poems would travel between their homes, sometimes via mailbox rather than hedge, addressed to a house merely a stone's throw away. Around this time, Dickinson began dressing exclusively in white, binding poems into hand-stitched booklets, and retreating into near-total withdrawal. For the remaining quarter century of her life, she would write at her miniature desk, receive visitors as a disembodied voice through the parlor door, and rarely leave her bedroom. Her room faced southwest, not west, as she described it. The western windows framed the evergreens, so close yet unreachable. Within these constraints, Dickinson created infinities of beauty and meaning, coming out into the world only as discarnate verses strung with breathless dashes. Rachel Carson first encountered the ocean during her senior year of college, finding it so vast, mysterious, and immensely powerful that words failed her. Born in landlocked Pennsylvania, she'd spent her youth roaming woods and communing with birds while dreaming of unseen seas. At 19, a transformative biology class awakened in her an awareness of the glorious interleaving of all life. She discovered that biology has given me something to write about, forging her conviction that science and literature exist in vital symbiosis. Her book, The Sea Around Us, enchanted both lay readers and scientists. Carson had tracked the dangers of chemical pesticides for years, collecting studies documenting mass deaths following DDT spraying. Despite battling cancer, she completed her manuscript in January 1962, experiencing cathartic release. The thoughts of all the birds and other creatures and all the loveliness that is in nature came to me with such a surge of deep happiness that now I had done what I could. These figures across centuries refused artificial boundaries between disciplines, between genders, between the cosmic and the intimate. We will all die. What survives are shoreless seeds and stardust. In this cosmic perspective, our brief lives gain significance, each a unique configuration of atoms capable of wonder, love, and creation.